Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What power lies in baby brains, waiting to be cultivated and unlocked by nurturing care and stimulation? The blossoming of a helpless newborn into a walking, talking toddler takes place over just a couple of years. And just as miraculous as the changes we can see are the ones we can't, an estimated 100 trillion neural connections formed in the brain by age 3. Much of that progress, of course, depends on an environment full of stimulating experiences and nurturing reliable caregivers. Joining us to talk about brain development at the beginning of life and what it suggests about the needs of underprivileged kids in particular is science writer Udijit Bhattacharjee. His article, The First Year, appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. Udijit, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
You start this article with what was a stunning revelation about the so-called crack babies of the 1980s. They indeed had lower than average IQs, but when researchers studied them compared to their poor but unexposed peers, they couldn't find significant differences.
That's exactly right. And the researchers were extremely surprised because they expected the thinking back then was that these babies had been tremendously damaged by exposure to drugs in the womb. And yet, what they found was that there wasn't much of a difference between kids who had been exposed to drugs before they were born and kids who hadn't been exposed. The actual difference came from something else.
And it looks like the culprit was poverty.
That's right. And so when the researchers were studying this entire group, you know, both groups taken together, they realized that the correlation between IQ was not with cocaine exposure, but actually with how poor, you know, the mother had been and how much stress the mother had as she was raising the kids.
I want to be clear here, as you are in the article and as your interview subject was, no one is arguing that drug use is not harmful to babies. This is simply looking at other things that seem to damage their brain development.
That's right. I mean, this is not, you know, nobody's saying that if you become pregnant and take drugs, that's good for your baby. It's just that something else seems to be playing a very significant role in the baby's intelligence.
So why do poor children tend to receive less caregiver nurturing than children from more economically privileged families?
That's a very good question. And I actually spoke to some of the subjects in this study. I spoke to a woman who had taken to prostitution because, you know, she had no other means of raising her child. And she told me how she used to leave her baby, you know, at the crack house for hours together as she, you know, went about trying to make a living and then came back and, you know, was hardly able to give the baby enough attention. Even later, you know, a couple of years later when the baby was 2 or 3 years old, you know, she was able to clean up her act. And she was able to become a better mother. But even then, the stresses of daily life were so intense that she wasn't able to, you know, really nurture her baby in the way that that she wanted to. And I think that, you know, I actually looked at some of the videos that the University of Pennsylvania's researchers took when they visited her at home, you know, 20 years ago when she was raising the child. And you could tell just from the state of the home and just from, you know, her manner that she was under a lot of stress and she didn't have a whole lot of time to provide warmth and nurturing to her baby.
On the other hand, poor kids who do, for whatever reason, get lots of stimulation and lots of good attention tend not to suffer these intellectual deficits, which suggests that nurturing is critical for brain development. Can you tell us a little bit about how the size of the hippocampus in young children helps to illustrate this?
So one of the things that that this research group, whose work I reported on in the National Geographic story, one of the things they did was that they, you know, they kept score. They basically came up with a scoring system to measure two things: nurturance and stimulation in the home environment of these children. And through periodic home visits, you know, they assessed nurturance and stimulation. Nurturance was, you know, how well the baby was, you know, being held, and you know, if the baby was receiving a lot of, you know, loving care and that sort of thing. And stimulation had to do with reading, you know, with sort of intelligent conversation that the parent was having with the child, and so on. And later, you know, as the kids were growing older, when the researchers looked at the brains of the kids when they had turned, you know, 8 years old or 9 years old, they found that the hippocampus in the children who had received better nurturing and better stimulation was sort of more like that of the average, normal, healthy 9 year old, as opposed to kids who had received less of those things. And so that actually, you know, that was quite eye opening because it showed a direct physical impact on the brain by these two factors of nurturance and stimulation.
This is not in your article, but reading it, I was thinking about, you know, babies born generations and even centuries ago, when a lot of people didn't think, you know, that an infant had much intellectual capacity at all, and people were very busy just, you know, sort of trying to keep everybody alive. And I wonder if some of the problems that people had back then were related to, I'm sure some of them got really nurturing care, but probably a lot of babies didn't get the kind of attention we expect for infants now.
I think that's a very plausible, you know, insight, and I'm sure that as more is studied, you know, we will be able to sort of unpack what happened, you know, generations ago with children who were being raised in extremely stressful environments and weren't receiving, you know, enough warmth and attention.
How does the number of neurons in a newborn compare with those in an adult brain?
I don't remember the exact figures, but actually a newborn has, I think, something like 100 billion neurons. And I believe that over time, actually, the number of neurons or the number of neural connections is ultimately goes down. I would have to refer to my own article.
I think what you said was that it's almost equivalent. We're born with as many neurons as we're going to have, so there's a lot of potential in a newborn brain.
That's exactly right. And so it's really the shaping and molding of the brain by the environment that is, you know, that's powerful in determining who we become as adults.
From a stunningly early age, infants are tuned to the nuances of language. They're listening for patterns before they even understand words.
That's right. And as I report in my story, researchers have found that babies are extremely sensitive to the sequence of sounds. You know, I mean, when they're as old as 3 days, 5 days old, you know, they're still able to discern the differences between, you know, a sound like ka, ge, nu and ka, ge, ge. I mean, that discerning power is reflected in the experiments that researchers have done with newborns and kids that are a little bit older. And that's, you know, that's not something you'd expect. You look at a baby and you think, wow, you know, that's a really cute baby, but what does a baby really know? Well, it turns out that the baby knows quite a bit already and then has the capacity to learn at a tremendous rate in the first few weeks, months, and years of its life.
So for people you did it who are thinking, why are you strapping babies into these machines and imaging that they can tell the difference between, you know, ka, ge, nu and ka, ge, ge, what it suggests is that language development doesn't necessarily progress in a linear fashion from sounds to words to grammar, but in fact it begins to happen all at once.
Right. So the prevailing view a few years ago was, and of course this is how you would think about it, trying to understand how we grasp language, we think, first you learn the alphabet, then you learn words, then you learn sentences, and then you are able to read. And so people imagine that infants learned language in a similar way, where they would learn units of sound and what they represented, and then slowly graduate to learning, more complex sounds that were combinations of various sounds, and then go on to learn rules of grammar. But it turns out, as I just said, the sequence of sounds is essentially a key to grammar, because that's what distinguishes one sentence from another. The way in which words, the same words, are organized will change the meaning of a sentence. In the same way, babies are able to discern from an early age, the differences between different patterns of sound, and not just that, they're able to infer rules of grammar from those differences.
And grammar is a really complex thing. I mean, we argue about, funny things like prepositions and all that, but what people who learn to speak a language don't get confused is the difference between, say, John ate the cookie and the cookie ate John. People don't make those mistakes.
That's right. I use a similar example in the story. And I think that, what that goes to show is the sort of remarkable power of the baby to identify patterns in speech, and then using those patterns kind of work out certain rules of grammar that are specific to the language that the baby is being exposed to. You don't really think of language in that way, and yet that's how it seems to work in children.
We've heard a lot in recent years about the word gap between the children of poor or uneducated parents and those raised by better educated parents in wealthier circumstances. First of all, can you remind us what the term word gap describes?
So several years ago, there were two researchers, Hart and Risley, who sort of performed a study where they counted up the total number of words that were being spoken to children in homes that were, relatively well-to-do and in poorer homes. And they discovered this striking sort of difference, this striking gap between the number of words spoken in the relatively wealthier homes and the poorer ones. And the gap, I believe, was almost several thousand words a day. In fact, by the age of, I believe, four, the total word gap was something like 30 million. That's what word gap means, but I can tell you more about it.
All right, we'll jump in and take a break here. My guest is Udijit Bhattacharjee. He's a science writer whose article, The First Year, appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science writer Udijit Bhattacharjee. His article, The First Year, appears in the January issue of National Geographic. It's about brain development in infants and very young children. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, Udijit, we have established that there can be a word gap of as many as 30 million words heard more by children raised in privileged circumstances than those who are raised in poverty. Why does that word gap matter? What does it yield?
Right. So it's not just the number of words, but it's also the nature of the conversations that are taking place between the parent and the child. And so in the case of, you know, the poorer homes where the kids were hearing fewer words, not only were they getting less language interaction, but the parents were speaking in sort of clipped, you know, sentences like stop that or get off the table. Whereas in the wealthier homes, in the more privileged homes, the children were hearing sort of extended, you know, conversations on a number of topics where the parents were encouraging the kid, you know, like, is that a tram? What color is the tram, et cetera, which essentially translated to a much better linguistic nutrition, if you will. And that turns out, you know, had a huge impact on these kids. Later on, by the age of 9 and 10, the kids who had received this better nutrition were doing much better at school and had higher IQs.
So it's not simply that better educated parents have larger vocabularies and kids are picking up on that. It's the quality of the interactions over time and the sort of give and take of conversation?
That's exactly right. Because, you know, language, I mean, just think about it. Language is sort of our window onto everything else in the world, you know, cause and effect, relationships, emotions, our entire knowledge of the world and how things work. We communicate that through language. And so for the kid to hear, you know, the difference between simply being told, you know, to get off the table and put on one's clothes and hearing, you know, a sort of an exposition of, you know, a parade going down the street, that difference can be monumental. And just, you know, over time, cumulatively, that can make a big difference to how the kids turn out later in life.
So it might seem reasonable to assume that we could put kids who are in somewhat deprived environments in front of like a great TV show and have articulate characters talking to them. But it turns out these materials are no substitute for direct human interaction.
Wouldn't that be so convenient? Mm. it turns out that those devices, you know, are almost useless to a large extent because I report in the story the work of Patricia Kuhl, this amazing researcher at the University of Washington, who studied how kids who were being taught Chinese, who were being taught Mandarin, actually, in you know, through audiovisual materials, you know, through a video, instructional videos, and so on, how those kids fared in their discernment and understanding of that language as compared to kids who learned the language through weekly social interactions with tutors. It's as if the kids, you know, the kids who were exposed to the audiovisual materials were almost the same. They were no better off than kids who didn't receive any Mandarin instruction at all. Whereas the other kids, were picking up the language. And so what that experiment showed was that social interaction is really key It's not just exposure to, you know, to a screen or an audio tape, you know, or songs or music, you know, all of which can be helpful, but it turns out that social interaction and how the information is being delivered through visual cues, you know, through inflection, you know, through an actual person delivering that interaction, you know, that is what, you know, leads to a lot more learning.
What does all this suggest for children who are in daycare? Do we need to insist on childcare workers who have large vocabularies and lots of education? Because as much as that sounds ideal, it probably isn't economically feasible for a lot of families.
That's true. I mean, I think, you know, I have two children and both of them went to daycare. You know, my little one is 4 years old and she still goes to daycare. She goes to a very good daycare and the teachers there are very nice and they engage with the children. And so I would say, you know, it is important for daycares to be cognizant of the fact that you can't just stick, you know, the kids in front of a television, you know, for hours on end, that you need to be playing with them, interacting with them, reading to them, talking to them, exercise, you know, encouraging them to exercise their imaginations and so on, you know, which most daycares that are, you know, that are half decent actually do. So I wish there were a simple answer to your question. But I think we're all, you know, we're all struggling to find the right balance so that we can give our kids the right amount of nurturing and stimulation, and yet, you know, have good jobs that will, you know, bring home the bacon, so that we can give them a better education in the future, and you know, put bread on the table.
Does it make you crazy to have young children and to do this kind of work for a living? I mean, do you run home like twice a week to your wife and say, okay, here's what we have to do? Or does it all just sort of confirm what you've been doing?
Well, it has certainly, you know, in the course of reporting this particular story, I've certainly been racked by guilt, you know, off and on. Recently, you know, I do read to my daughter quite a bit. But, you know, there's also times when I'm on Facebook, you know, on the iPhone, and I just want her to go away and play by herself while I can, you know, click like on a joke. And recently, you know, it was this reality was brought home to me by my daughter. She found an old phone and she started to try to call me on this old phone, thinking that maybe she would get more of my attention that way. And of course, it was just a game to her, but it was also a reminder to me that that there are times when, you know, I should be paying attention to her, even though it's been a stressful day and I'm preoccupied with other things like writing my next story or something. And yet, you know, her whole future, at least to some extent, is dependent on the quality of interactions that my wife and I and other adults are able to give her.
How does physical touch relate to brain development? And you know, there are other kinds of nurturing besides simply, you know, talking to children.
That's right. I think, you know, the emotional development of children depends to a great extent on, you know, how much they're held and cared for in physical ways in their early childhood. I mean, I don't think it's coincidental that that children look for that kind of attention, and that parents are naturally sort of inclined to give that kind of attention to their children. And perhaps evolution has made children so cute, you know, in order to garner that kind of physical attention from parents, which seems to be very important for their emotional development. I mean, this is really well sort of chronicled through the study of Romanian orphanages, where thousands of children, you know, have suffered the fate of basically being left almost unattended entirely for hours in cribs, you know, without any parent or any caregiver coming to, you know, to hug them or hold them or pick them up. And these kids, you know, have grown up, and many of them have emotional problems. They're having difficulties adjusting to life. It's a very sad story, and I think it really proves the point that you were making, that touch or the interaction of touch is important to development.
Researchers did discover that at least some of those orphans in Romania who were fortunate enough to be placed in supportive foster housing or adoptive families, some of them recovered after that early deprivation because they were then in more nurturing environments.
Yes, and that was, you know, a very heartwarming aspect of the study where these researchers were able to place some of the kids in foster homes, and because, you know, the researchers provided support to the foster homes, they gave them toys, books, and other forms of material assistance, so that the kids would have a nurturing and stimulating environment. And when they tested, when they measured the brain activities of the kids who had spent a few years in foster, they saw that the brain activity resembled that of normal, you know, average kids that had grown up in loving homes from childhood. And so that shows that, you know, with intervention, it is possible to reverse the effects of early deprivation.
What does this research suggest about helping children in this country who have already fallen behind? They may live with their families, but they haven't had quite as much care as they need. And before they ever set foot in kindergarten, they lack some of the skills that their peers might have.
Well, there's a lot of, researchers who are actively working to develop interventions for exactly those kinds of kids. Who for no fault of their own or even their families have fallen behind because they didn't get enough nurturing and enough attention, enough stimulation in their early years. Some of these programs, one of them I write about in the National Geographic piece, try to teach parents to be better parents, essentially. And I'm sure, you know, all of us, you know, I just gave you my example, all of us could be better parents than we are. But specifically, the program teaches parents to have better conversations with their kids, to sort of lower their own stress levels when the kid is not listening or not complying with instruction, and also, you know, to engage the kids in activities, including reading, that are more imaginative, that are more stimulating. For example, going to a museum or, having them, pick out, different objects, assembling sort of a whole tub of objects like a pencil, a little toy boat, a piece of candy, and ask which of these things is more likely to float in water, and then performing an experiment to confirm whatever hypothesis the child and the parent came up with together. So these are just ways of, they all sound like very simple things. But actually, taken together, they could have a profound effect on the child's future.
And I guess the great thing about those interventions is that the training itself might have a negligible cost, but doing these things at home doesn't have to really cost anything for families that are struggling. Just a little time.
That's exactly right. And in fact, many of these programs have been developed taking into consideration that the parents might not be well-educated. They may not be great readers. You know, they might, you know, some of them might not even be able to read. And yet there's enough activities that they can do with their children, even when they go to the grocery store, that would change the whole dynamic. And that, I think, is sort of the encouraging aspect of this whole body of research that we could make a difference in the lives of millions of kids by spreading awareness and by having parents sort of realize how much effect they are having by engaging with or not engaging with their children.
Do you think, I mean, I wonder what your perspective is on the instinct of parenting. Some things seem very obvious, you know, protect them and feed them and care for them. But it seems that other things are affected very much by culture, by our socioeconomic background, that sort of thing.
Indeed. I think it's also, you just maybe 10 or 15 minutes ago, you were talking about how perhaps there have been times in history when kids received very little attention and nurturing, and as a result, you know, sort of didn't develop as well as they could have. I do think that today, you know, we're living, in a time where you have both parents working. Most families require both parents to be working outside of the home to bring in enough money. And so there's less and less, available time to the family, to the two parents as a whole, to engage with their kids as well as they would like to. In this country, I think that is true of millions of homes, and I think that could change.
We're speaking to science writer Udijit Bhattacharjee about his article in the January National Geographic called The First Year. If you'd like to share how you have stimulated your children as they grew, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also tell a story or ask a question via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science journalist Udijit Bhattacharjee. His article, The First Year, appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Another thing, Udijit, that young children, very young children, are beginning to learn, even in infancy, is this thing called emotional regulation, right? They learn to sort of understand and cope with their own moods. Can you talk about how nurturing affects that?
Right. I was just talking about these intervention programs, and one key element of them is being able to teach both parents and children to regulate their emotions better. A commonsensical idea is that if your parent is not able to regulate their own emotions, then you as a child are going to role model that behavior, and you're likely to be emulating whatever they're doing. You know, if they're blowing a gasket every time things are not going their way, well, you as a child are likely to do the same thing. So that's why some of these programs are focused on teaching both parents how to regulate their own emotions and stay calm in difficult situations, especially as it relates to parenting, but also, give children sort of the the tools, language being one of them, to sort of express their feelings and get over them.
Some of this research also points to at least a partial explanation for things like multi-generational poverty, right? The reasons why it's hard to change, you know, to move from where you are unless you're raised in a really different way than your parents before you.
Indeed. Early on, I mentioned that I've spoken to some of the subjects in the University of Pennsylvania study. And, you know, one of the kids who I sort of interviewed at length was the kid of this woman who had to resort to prostitution for a few years. So she had a rough life. And so the kid didn't do very well at school. He didn't get the attention and the stimulation in early childhood. By fourth grade, he was already well behind his peers in IQ and just in general academic performance. Then he dropped out of school. And then at the age of 11 or 12, you know, he stole from a store, and then he repeated that offense several times. These were all sort of minor thefts and burglaries, but they really set him on this course of, you know, of a life where he wasn't going to finish his education, and he didn't. Then obviously he had trouble getting even a basic minimum wage job. And by the age of 20, he had already had his own child that he was now struggling to raise. And so if you just look at this whole picture, you can see how poverty is almost working like a gene, that's being inherited from one generation to the other. And the mechanism through which this inheritance is taking place is through, stress in the life of the parent caused by poverty, leading the parent to pay less attention and provide less nurturance and stimulation to their children. And then the child affected by that does not so well in life later on. I mean, obviously, I'm painting a very simplistic, cartoonish
Sure.
picture. But in general terms, I did find this to be true for several of the families that were a part of this Philadelphia study.
It's got to be interesting to talk to people who are sort of on the other end of this. And are some of the people who are now young adults that look back on a less than ideal childhood, are they able to recognize the differences? Do they feel like maybe their childhood was different than other people they might have gone to school with or something?
Certainly. Toward the end of my story, I talk about a young mother, Tana Argo, who lives in Oregon. She participated in the intervention program that I talk about. She has four kids of her own, and she's learned a lot from the intervention program that was developed at the University of Oregon. And she told me that that I would never let the same things that happened to me happen to my kids, because looking back, she can see. She can see what she was deprived of. Now that she's in her late 20s, she started having kids fairly early, and so she's seen enough of the world. She's interacted with her neighbors, and people who've had better childhoods to know what she missed out on, and she's determined not to let the same pattern repeat with her kids. So I do think that that people who've had a difficult time, who haven't received the warm attention and the stimulating environment that many other kids in more privileged homes have received, I think they do look back and see what they've missed, and I think that gives them I think a sense of, understanding about, why they are where they are. And I think it's valuable.
Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Beverly who says, before having children, I took some early childhood education classes and realized how important these were. I believe that because this is crucial to our everyday life, and it should be a mandatory class in high school, even if it's just one semester. Seems like the sort of idea that would make a lot of sense.
Absolutely. I think, Beverly was very smart to do that. I wish somebody had given me the same advice. I do think that, parenting is a huge responsibility, and, to utter sort of an oft-repeated phrase that you're never really prepared to be a parent. Indeed, that is true. But I think, you should try and be as well prepared as you can be, because it is a huge responsibility. It just changes our whole lives. Many of us are just completely unable to cope in the first few years. We're just struggling to sort of, catch up on sleep and feed the baby and, change the baby's diapers and then watch some TV, once the baby goes to sleep. I mean, it's just, those are the things that I did, when my first child was born. And now looking back, I can see how, I may have missed certain opportunities to provide a more nurturing, caring, first few years for my son and my daughter.
Well, I'm sure you did the best you could, right? You can't make yourself crazy either.
Right, of course, yeah. But I'm just saying that I applaud Beverly for having taken those classes, and I hope that they're serving her well now.
Reading your story made me remember once again how much respect I have for researchers who are doing these ethical experiments on very young children and with their parents. The sort of design of some of these is really interesting. The way that they have to think through how to demonstrate whether their ideas are in fact true or false.
Indeed. Let's just start with, the tools that are used to measure, brain waves and brain activity in these newborns and, three-month-old kids, 9-month-old kids. I mean, this is really hard stuff, to make a device that will not pierce the skull of a baby in order to learn what's going on inside the baby's head. So that, of course, is the physical aspect of it. And then, these intervention programs, just as I wrote about in the coverage of the Romanian orphan study or the study out of the University of Oregon, where they're teaching parents to be better parents. Ethically speaking, if you know that an intervention works, then you probably, are obligated to offer that intervention to all the kids in the group, to all the families in your group. But of course you can't do that, because then you can't prove that it actually makes a difference. And so I think that, researchers who work, in this area have to wrestle with a lot of ethical questions as they're designing their experiments and executing them.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Michael on the line in West Virginia. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I'm a first-time caller, but I do listen. I enjoy your show.
Welcome.
I just wanted to give a little insight. I'm the youngest of three children. And my mom had me when she was 18, so three kids by the time she was 18, I'm sure it was a huge burden. She couldn't handle it. So I went to my grandfather's house. I was adopted by my grandfather and my step-grandmother. My brother went to my original grandmother's house, and my sister stayed with my mom. My brother and sister both of those houses were, you know, pretty low income. My real mother and my real grandmother are both a little out there. But my grandfather and my step-grandmother, you know, they made good money. They were real nurturing. They, you know, did all the things you guys have been talking about. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but I turned out a ton better than my other two siblings did. Mm. So I've always kind of felt like what you guys are talking about is true. But, you know, this just kind of confirms that it does play a huge impact. Wanted to hear what you guys have to say about that.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. What do you think?
No, that's, you know, that's really a concrete example of what we're talking about. And as a matter of fact, you know, in the course of reporting this story, I came across families where, you know, it was, you know, one solid grandparent or, you know, an aunt or an uncle, you know, that really sort of stood by the kid and provided the support and the nurturing, you know, that the kid needed. And that made all the difference, even if the parents themselves were unable to do the same thing. So it's, you know, I think that, you know, you see this a lot in many poor families where the parents are struggling and yet there's one member of the family, oftentimes the grandmother, who is, you know, who makes supreme sacrifices for the grandchildren to provide them the kind of childhood that she was not able to provide to her son or daughter when she was a young mother herself. You know, sometimes this is the grandparents' way of kind of making amends for what they weren't able to do earlier.
There's just no substitute for somebody being there and paying that attention. We, no matter how many apps are sold to us or DVDs or whatever, you gotta put in the sweat equity with your kids.
That's absolutely right. I think, you know, I think as we just, you know, our lives are getting busier, and just, you know, just finding the time to, you know, to sort of balance our, you know, our ambitions, our pursuits of pleasure with, you know, with our responsibilities towards our children. I think, you know, it's just becoming more and more difficult, and I think we need to seriously think about how we can change that in the years to come.
Udijit Bhattacharjee's article, The First Year, appears in the January issue of National Geographic magazine. Udijit, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.